Welcome to MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website to get caught up on our previous episodes. The last thing we talked about was I'm Not There. One person has told me it is a good podcast, so you can check that out. That's a high number of people commenting on our podcast. And before that, we talked about Galaxy Quest, and before that, People versus O.J. Simpson, and previous to that, Batman versus Superman, a Dawn of Justice. Also follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Men, and I think that's about it.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Mm-hmm.
You're the more Irish of the two of us. You want to introduce this one for us?
We are talking about 1982's The Verdict.
Yes.
Which takes place in Boston. Is that the Irish thing?
There just seems to generally be a lot of Irishness.
Oh, yeah.
Pervading through the film.
That's true. That's true.
Let's put it this way. Frank Galvin is a more Irish name than not. I would say. Yeah. Francis Galvin. Anyway, The Verdict, directed by Sidney Lumet, written by David Mamet, starring Paul Newman.
It's a power trio right there.
It really is.
You chose this one. What made you want to do this film?
I mean, I've liked it for a long time. You know, I have a weakness for Paul Newman, but I just think it's a really good movie, and I like Sidney Lumet a lot, and it's widely regarded as a pretty good movie, so I figured might as well talk about it.
Yeah, it got 5 pretty big Oscar nominations and won none of them.
Yeah,
I mean, it was very well reviewed at the time. I don't hear it talked about that often anymore, but it is held in high regard in certain circles, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly. The people that know. The people in the know, you know?
Sure.
That's a Mamet level dialogue right there.
Yeah, but as I said, best picture, best director, best actor, best supporting actor, and best adapted screenplay, and missed out on all of them.
Yeah, I mean... Paul Newman's eventual Oscar for The Color of Money was his apology Oscar for this, you know, like, so I don't remember. Maybe that was Kingsley's year, 82.
It was.
Okay. So I don't know. You can't beat a biopic, I think, is one thing we've learned over the years, right?
Yeah. That was Gandhi. And as you said, Ben Kingsley. Yeah. Where do you rate this for Paul Newman performances?
As far as movies I've seen, I think. It's not his most movie starry performance, but I think he's really, really good in it. I don't know.
What do you mean by that? What's the difference for you?
I mean, like, Cool Hand Luke is a performance that I love, and it's a movie where he is just so so charming and so charismatic and so likable all the time. And it's just that, like, that lovable ruffian that Paul Newman played so well. And and he's great at it, but there's something that seems like a higher degree of difficulty for him in this movie. And, but you don't see the strain that comes from that. So I think it's kind of just it's more impressive, you know, cause I feel like, whatever Luke's last name is in Cool Hand Luke, I feel like Paul Newman, the person, is closer to that than he is to Frank Galvin, you know?
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
This is, I mean, it was a role that a lot of people wanted, though. It's that weighty, you know, down on your luck character who has a moral struggle and ends up doing the right thing. It's not as though it's not the kind of role a lead actor would want.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, we saw it a couple of years ago. It's this type of movie still exists with The Judge. And that was like a Robert Downey Jr. passion project that the studio kind of did him a favor in making. And he played a down on his luck attorney, you know, and it's like, because you get these just by the structure of the genre, you tend to have a couple pretty good meaty speeches that you get to really sink your teeth into. And that's something that actors really enjoy, because it's the time when everybody else has to shut the hell up and let them do their work, as opposed to them sitting in the trailer for 6 more hours, you know?
Right. So. Yeah. And a character of, fighting for the little guy is often a big part of these courtroom dramas.
Yeah.
And which is an element of characters, obviously, a lot of actors want to have.
Exactly. Especially as they get further and further removed from the little guy. You know? And I right. mean, in Paul Newman's case, he was always very big on trying to help the little guy when he could, you know, so you can really see in his case why he would be interested in it.
Yeah, and this movie was based on a novel. This movie came out in 1982, but the novel was released in 1980, mm-hmm. Written by Barry Reed, and was optioned for a book, or optioned for a film immediately. And as I said, there's a lot of big names at the time who wanted to be the star of this.
Yeah, Redford was attached, right?
Yep, he was attached for a while, and then I think he wasn't happy with the script and eventually started talking with some other directors about it, and the producers did not like that and fired him, is my understanding.
Yeah, I love the idea of anybody firing Robert Redford. It's so great, especially in like 82, you know, like we're coming out of peak Redford, and I love that. And I mean, Redford is a meddler. It's notorious, like everybody knows it. So I could see somebody getting pissed off about it, but I like the idea of some producers being big enough that they can be like, this isn't worth it. We're losing control of our movie, you know?
Yeah, you are one of the biggest stars in the world right now, but oh well.
But yeah, we're gonna call your buddy instead.
That's right. And yeah, my understanding is that they went through a lot of scripts even after they had the people on it that they ended up shooting the movie with.
Yeah. And I think the way that Sidney Lumet came to the movie is that after they fired Redford, they kind of went through the producers went kind of reset the whole thing, and when they were trying to sell Lumet on the movie, they didn't send him the novel, they sent him all of the various screenplay drafts that exist, because David Mamet's was, I believe, the first, but they got other people to write versions of it as well, and Sidney Lumet signed on to the project having not read the novel, and just off of Mamet's screenplay, and he said that that was the one he wanted to make, and then they were off, you know.
Yeah. So. And recently the Writers Guild of America called it one of the top 100 scripts ever written, so mm-hmm. I guess he had a good eye for it, you could say.
Yeah, I mean, and Lumet throughout his career has been, I mean, we talked about this a lot on the Dog Day Afternoon podcast, but he's very malleable. Like, he's unbelievably talented, and but also doesn't need his talents to be showcased all the time. Like, in a movie that's very dialogue heavy, Network, another great example of it, he knows how to pick his spots, you know. And there are a lot of scenes in this movie that in The Verdict that are told in just wide angle master shots, basically, for whole takes, you know, like, or sorry, long takes for whole scenes. And Lumet really, really picks his spots, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, because this movie, kind of as you've described, isn't that showy, I find, in a lot of ways. You know, it's not that flashy. Even, you know, the delivery of the verdict itself right at the end, there's not the huge buildup, and there's not a lot of uses of music to really, you know, stylize and communicate a lot of the feeling that you're supposed to get from it. It's kind of just out there in the dialogue and the acting, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things I like the most about the direction of this movie is the way that it just kind of, like, I don't know, just kind of, it feels like it just kind of sits there. Like, that sounds like a negative, but it really feels like with the sound design, and part of that is having very little music throughout the film, just that you kind of feel more immersed in the world simply because there are fewer cuts, and all of the camera moves, well, the vast majority of the camera moves are very subtle. And it just helps you to have a more immersive experience and really feel closer to Frank, you know, just because there are fewer of these artificial things to take you out of these artifices of filmmaking, you know?
Yeah, and I think that the best example of that, or maybe my favorite in the movie, is watching the Polaroids develop, which is a pretty big turning point for the Frank Galvin character. But I think that was a good way to kind of just let you sit and deal with that. I mean, we've been in that room already in the movie, but just, I think, executing it in that manner really kind of, you know, puts you in his place, and puts a bit more weight behind that emotional shift, which, it's not a plot point, it's not an action-driven moment, but it's so important to the central character and by extension the story.
Yeah, absolutely. And the confidence that it takes to know that that you're doing everything well enough that you can sit on this, I don't know, 15-second shot of Polaroids developing. Maybe it's even longer. And it's that type of like old school confidence that Sidney Lumet had that almost nobody still has, you know. And and I really enjoy that.
Yeah, I thought you might. I really liked it. It was, as you said, a confident thing, but just a very important part of the movie and a interesting way to communicate something just emotionally.
Yeah, exactly. And like when I first watched this movie, it was probably almost 10 years ago, and I knew so much less about film then, but I still have that it's all of those things that I've described really worked on me even then, you know. Like it really does pull you in because it refuses to take the easy way out of a lot of things and just sort of expose you to things, like just to show you things as opposed to leading you around from place to place, you know.
Yeah. And then right after that, when he's told by the nurse that he's not allowed to be in there and he says, "I'm her attorney," he says it with a certain amount of conviction, and again, you could really ham up the writing there and have him kind of start on some mini speech about how it's his right and, you know, his responsibility to defend her and all these things, but he just says, "I'm her attorney," but it comes out with so much more gravitas, partly because of the way that was shot and a good Paul Newman performance, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, he's great in this movie.
What else did you like about this?
Oh, it's, I mean, it's a lot of that simplicity. I like the way that the more melodramatic touches with the with Frank's alcoholism. I like the way that they are. Okay, so there's a really good separation of the case and Frank's personal problems, specifically his alcoholism, because even though they're, you know, we're seeing both of these stories at the same time throughout the movie, there is a real separation from how they're presented, right? Like, we've talked about how music isn't used very much. I think there are three music cues in the movie other than the end credits. And
that's Hey, in that time he talks to Laura and she says she's not really going to give him sympathy. Or yeah. You know, it's not Sunday and you want to, I'm your mom and you want out of school. What are the other ones?
When he trashes his office at the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
And
which brought me back to Cool Hand Luke drunk and destroying the parking meters.
Yes. And yeah, that scene ends very differently from Frank. You see, Luke's still fun drinking at that point. You know?
That's true. And I thought he was playing drunk, because it appears hard and it can be very messy sometimes. But I thought he was a good drunk in this.
Oh, no, I would agree. And I can't remember the third. Maybe there are only two. But they're all tied to his personal struggles as opposed to the case. They're all moments when he doubts himself or when alcohol has taken over. When the verdict is read, there is no swelling music or anything like that. It's just the verdict, you know, like the thing that is that they really want you to focus more on is Frank's personal struggle, right? Like the case is just part of what he is going through, and it's good that he uses this to try and help others, you know. But it really focuses more on what it does for Frank than anything else. You know, we don't even, like, the money doesn't matter. We don't see what the jury ends up awarding Frank, right? Like, it's just so important that he succeeds. And not only does he try the case, but he tries it successfully and does a good thing, you know? And the money that he gets out of it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. It matters. It matters, of course. You know, it's not like he's like, oh no, keep the money, you know? But like, but it doesn't matter as much as the actual personal success.
Right. And the fact is illustrated as well by the personal note being the one we leave on. This movie ends not with just the fact that he's won. It's something more regarding his personal life is what you're left with.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I'm sure we'll get to that scene, but the another thing that I think is really good and runs throughout this whole movie is the theme of old world and institutions and it's pervasive. You've got hospitals, you've got religion, you've got lawyers or the legal system, you've got a judge that clearly should not be a judge anymore. And just all of these, like, these really old institutions that exist and that you have to deal with, and there's no way around it. But trying to deal with them in a way that is actually helpful for people, for individuals. And I found that really interesting. And even just in the way that the movie is, like the locations that the movie takes place in. There's like all of these rooms are just filled with old wood, and it feels like an old movie. You know, it's like this guy finally decides to break from the old institutionalized way that even he was a part of. You know, he was a part of a law firm that didn't do the right thing, you know, and and just to be the glimmer of hope, you know, just one time, you know, just to see, just to make sure that humanity can still win, even though all these institutions have the upper hand at pretty much at all times, you know.
Yeah, just all the time spent in the court and all these very, you know, ornate buildings and structures, and the bailiffs walking around with their jury sticks before and after the jury comes and goes.
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very old world like that.
Yeah. So what did you like about this movie?
Well, I wanted to say one more thing about religion since it came up. Mm-hmm. You know, the opponent in this movie, the antagonist, is, you know, either the opposing the law firm or, you know, the church and doctors. They're all kind of, you know, working together to be the force that at least the legal threat of this story is acting against. Mm-hmm. And it's not anti-religious in any means, though. It's, as you said, it's showing how these institutions can be problematic when they're so entrenched. But in his closing speeches and, you know, his summation and throughout the movie, in his opening, he talks about praying and, you know, doing the right thing by God and, you know, leaning on this idea that religion can steer you to the right thing to do. But this institution, this body is, I don't know if corrupt is the right word. I guess we don't ever see any full on corruption, but has kind of led astray. And I just wanted to point out that he is never railing against religion or faith by any means. He even uses that and seems to truly believe it for himself. But just the larger institution really has gotten away from the true meaning.
Yeah, exactly. And this movie, I mean, he does talk about religion a lot, and religion is clearly a big part of the movie, but the way that Frank even sort of proposes the idea of faith is still more it seems like it's more rooted in people than it is in actual belief in God, you know, like, because faith doesn't inherently mean a belief in God, you know, it just means a belief in something that outside of yourself, you know, and just the idea that that people can do good, you know, having faith in that, regardless of what you think about God, is something that I think is a strong idea in this movie, and something that I like seeing in movies. I mean, Interstellar is another good example of that, where you don't necessarily have to believe in God, you just have to believe that people will figure it out. And I like seeing that in movies, and I think this movie does a really good job of showing that.
Yeah, and on that point, I mean, without jumping to the end too much, but we're kind of there, it's the wrong verdict if we're playing by the rules.
Yeah.
You know what
100%.
I mean? There's no secret about that. The, what they call jury nullification, basically saying you've been instructed not to listen to this thing, or at least, you know, strike it from your memory, but you know the truth, you know, what you should do by the rules of the court is pretty much let this go, you know, overlook this, corruption, having the nurse go back and change what the sheet says and to lie about it for years. But he's saying sometimes the institutions just don't work. It's they're trying to, and these rules are there for a reason, but you know the truth. And yeah, I really feel the defense really should have just gone for a mistrial once that that testimony came out, because it's so damning. And you know, the reason they decide the way that they do is because they are ignoring the rules but following their morality.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think that's sort of established with the way when Concannon gets I forget the nurse's name, Costello Price, there it is.
Yeah.
When her testimony is stricken from the record, and the doctor, whose name I don't even have a hint of in my mind, but he's sitting next to Concannon, and he reaches over to touch Concannon's arm, and then Concannon like moves away from him. It's like he did his job, and which is what he's supposed to do, but he didn't feel great about it. You know, like it doesn't mean it's the right thing. You know,
yeah, and Frank also lies a lot throughout this movie to try to find Costello. You know, he has some pretty less than legal means, but working towards the right thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Frank, not a perfect man.
Yeah, well.
Hits a woman in the face in this movie.
Oh, yeah. Do you want to talk about that now?
Yeah, we should. This movie in general does not portray women as the strongest people in the world. I think that is a trend that exists in Mamet scripts in general, because often he is just not really great at character stuff in general. Like, he's really great at plot machinations, and when he makes his own movies, like, he does a lot of heist stuff that is always really entertaining. Like, I've seen all of the movies he's directed and they're all good, but never in the way that The Verdict is good, and as far as showing an interesting character, because one, as a director, he's not the most talented dude in the world. He's good, but he's not great. But also just because these characters are very, very often not fleshed out. And Laura is Charlotte Rampling's character is a very classic David Mamet type character, and that she's just kind of there to be pushed around by the plot, pushed around by other characters, slapped in the face by other characters at one point. The movie does not treat women well. There is a scene in this movie where Paul Newman hits her in the face and nobody really does anything about it. And it's really kind of not the easiest thing to watch, and not the way things should be done. And even in it's an old movie isn't an excuse, because 1982 is too late for that to happen. Yeah. I mean, it should have never happened, obviously, but like in the 40s, it's more usual. It's more normal, you know? Whereas 40 years later in 1982, it's just like, oh no, we're past this. Like,
yeah.
You don't just walk up to a woman in public and hit her in the face and they don't call the cops, you know?
Yeah. And the thing is, I really enjoyed how we just get the traffic noise over Frank being told that Laura has been, you know, is a mole for the other law firm. And I really like how they did that wordlessly. And I liked when he walked into the bar and you could tell she knows that he's figured it out somehow. And I was really loving how that scene was playing out. And then that happened.
And it's just like, no, Paul, no, you can't. No. You've done so much good with your salad dressings. Yeah, and that scene on the street with him and Mickey, that is, to my eye, the only time in the movie where they use a long lens. And what a long lens does is it compresses the background, like, just in the way that a lot more is out of focus. Like, especially when you see Mickey on the street for the first time, it's clear that they're using a zoom lens that's zoomed in very far on Mickey. And even when they're walking on the street, it's a longer lens than they typically use. And I think that that's really representative of where Frank is on the thing that Mickey's about to tell him. It's that he's so far away from the truth in this instance. And I thought that was a really cool little Sidney Lumet thing that he did. Yeah.
Yeah, I like the framing when he and Laura go back to his place for the first time, and he's kind of in the opposite corner where she is when he turns down the picture of his ex-wife.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that shot, too. There's a couple, I mean, for a movie that's mostly indoors in a city, you know, it's not the most beautiful location you would think, but I think this movie still looks good.
Oh, it looks great, and there are lots of good perspective shots, like the one that you just described, like Laura at the very end, how small she looks in the frame after Frank and Mickey have been successful in getting the verdict that they want. And another early one is when Frank is trying to convince Mickey to join the case. Like, they're talking on a staircase and or a set of stairs, and Frank is looking up at Mickey, and just the way that they're framed, Frank is being looked down on and is much smaller in the frame. And, you know, both of them are in the frame. We're shooting over the shoulder of Mickey and Frank looks small. And in the opposite shot, we just see Mickey and he looks huge and is shot from below. And it's like, Frank needs you way more than you need him, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a really good shot as well. And those types of things are peppered all throughout the movie.
Yeah. This isn't so much a perspective thing, but I wanted your take on the little meeting that they have with the judge before the trial even starts. You know, the one where he's eating on his desk there.
Yeah.
What did you make of that scene?
It's just in the way that the judge doesn't want to have to deal with the trial, that type of thing.
Yeah, I was thinking more visually, but anyway, you want to take it.
Well, I mean, he's the judge is handing things out to the other characters. I guess I haven't thought that much about it. And what I mean handing things out, I mean the coffee. He gives them both coffee at one point.
Yeah,
or maybe James Mason already had his coffee.
But. Yeah, and he's just offering them a way out too. But yeah, I like that. I also just enjoyed. He barely eats any of his food. You know, when he goes into the court just next door, everything's just on the table there. You know, everything was for the taking for Frank. If he wanted to, he could get his, you know, what would have been $70,000. Here's your last chance of taking the settlement. And, you know, the scene ends with everything there just, you know, untouched, unconsumed, and so much still left to be done. And I thought that was a nice little touch as well.
Yeah, for sure. Also, maybe that's why the judge really wants his lunch later on, because he regularly doesn't eat his breakfast. This judge, let's talk about how bad this judge is at being a judge real quick.
Do you think he's corrupt or just a bad judge?
I think what the movie is trying to show us is somebody that has been a part of their institution for too long. And it doesn't necessarily mean he's bad. It just means that you need a change. And the questioning Frank's witness is just like, even watching it now, knowing everything that happens in the movie, when it starts happening, I just feel this really strong feeling of rage. Like, no, this isn't done. You can't do this, you know?
Yeah. And Paul Newman gets to bust out a few dumbfounded faces in this movie things like that go down.
He's really good at the dumbfounded face, especially like with the slightly open mouth, you know, like it's one of Paul Newman's better skills, you know?
Yeah, no, that was good. What do you think happened to Dr. Gruber?
I don't know. I don't know. Because it's weird. Because it definitely seems like he must have been bought off, because he seems so confident in the way he was trying to talk Frank into going to trial. It seems like he has an effect on Frank, too. And it also seems like he couldn't drop everything and go on vacation. Like, he just doesn't have the schedule that would be conducive to that. So, like, if he is bribed and they're just like, oh, go to Costa Rica or wherever he is for a week, he'd have to be like, no, I have surgeries because I'm a very busy doctor. I smoke cigars and drive a Porsche. I've got to be in Cambridge, you know? So I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, it just seemed interesting because he was so adamant about getting these people out of the profession or however he phrased it, these bozos or clowns or whatever it was. And yeah, that's a real moment of just kind of very downbeat part of this movie, you know, because you have so few answers. And I think it's done well because Frank doesn't have the answer either. It could be legit, it could be a bribe, you know, there's a lot of different ways you could take it. He could have not even been that doctor the whole time and just, you know, set up this meeting with Frank so he would stop looking for doctors and then bail out. So who knows? But that does a good job of putting you in the very frustrated space that Frank's in at that time in the film.
Yeah, for sure. And I really enjoy the idea that this is just one person, like Gruber, the way he's talking, it's one person that feels like he just feels compelled to do the right thing. And I mean, he explains why he does, you know, he doesn't want these people mucking up his profession or however he puts it. But that really does seem to inspire Frank, and then gets augmented by the Polaroid scene, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We get a few moments of, you know, questioning authenticity, you know, why are you doing this? Do the right thing. Isn't that why you're doing this? And mm-hmm. I think you people are all the same, as said twice from different people.
Oh, yeah.
Just, you know, getting across the fact that these are people who've worked or dealt with these institutions, not worked in them. But, you know, someone else says, I think it's our defendant's brother-in-law, I guess.
Yes.
Says, you know, you guys do all this about winning and then it's us that lives with it. You know, it's just, it's a job or it's a win-loss record for these people. And then these outcomes affect the life of the little person, you know, forever.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's, I know, a theme that we've touched on already, too.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the things I really like about this movie is that Frank, the reason he decides to try the case is because, you know, he wants to do the right thing. He wants to win one for the little guy, quote unquote. One, he doesn't check with his client before doing that, which is a no-no, I would say.
Well, I think it's in the law that that's a no-no.
Yeah, yeah. and then when you see how mad they are when the brother-in-law does confront him, you kind of see that, yeah, these settlements do help somebody. You know, it's not like keeping this thing out of court doesn't help anybody. You know, you would have these people that benefit quite a bit from a settlement, you know, and the little guy still would have won. It just would have been fewer little guys that won, you know.
Yeah, but as he points out, I mean, this one settlement is, you know, this is the one thing in their way of a voluntary life change, and it's not Frank's call to choose that for them.
Yeah,
and I thought he was good, the brother-in-law, but this movie is pretty much front to back good performances, right?
Yes. I can't think of anybody that's bad in it.
Yeah. Well, we've barely talked about Mickey, which is unfair because I liked him a lot.
I mean, Jack Warden, Jack Warden gives you Jack Warden, you know, like he's pretty much, you know what you're getting from him, and he's great in everything. I don't mean that to sound like I don't like Jack Warden. I think he's great. But yeah, he's wonderful in this because he is Jack Warden and he is always wonderful.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you see that there was, for a while, the script didn't even show what the verdict was going to be?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, I think it was Mamet's original draft. They don't even include that. And earlier we were talking about how this is more about his personal struggle than the story, you know, the legal story, even though they definitely go hand in hand. I was wondering what you would think of that version of the movie where we don't even get that.
Mm-hmm. So what? How does the movie end? Do you know?
No, I'm not sure. I mean, it's I imagine it was pretty similar as far as the personal part of the story. We just don't get the level of closure on the legal thing.
I think that might have been too much. I mean, I should know better by now than to judge the skill of Sidney Lumet or doubt the skill of Sidney Lumet. But I don't know. It just feels like it would have been too much, too open ended, you know, because both sides of the story would have been left very open ended. You know?
Yeah. How do you feel about the open ended personal story? I mean, we know that he is better than he was at the start of the movie. I think we're left with the idea that he's recommitted to becoming an actual attorney. I think his ambulance chasing days are over. That scene of him crossing off obituaries was a total bummer. And
a lot of scenes in this movie are total bummers. Yeah, especially like the first 20 minutes. And, like, both of us being pretty pro Paul Newman, Paul Newman supporters, you know, like, and seeing him just really go through the ringer for the first part of this movie, it's a little tough.
Being kind of kicked out of that funeral is a pretty tough one. Oof, to watch too. Yeah. Not because I'm so sympathetic to Frank Galvin at that point, but that's just an awful thing to have happen or to witness.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the all-time sadness one, and I really like the very opening scene of this movie where he's playing pinball just quietly by himself, and it's just like, well, just another ball to go through here, you know. Yeah. Just another round. And the scene of him, I think it's between funerals when he is having his it's the obituary scene where he's got the donut on the newspaper and he can't lift the shot without shaking.
Oh.
That's like all-time sad.
Yeah.
And whoever's idea that was to have that, just great work, you know, like, as far, because it's like a good subtle way to show alcoholism, like, really being a big problem for this person. And the way it's played is really great, and just it's just such a sad action to have to do.
Yeah, and you just look like such a dummy drinking out of a cup that you're not lifting up. But
exactly, like Paul Newman, one of the most handsome people that has ever existed, and just looking like a dumb cat lapping milk out of a saucer.
Yeah, beer in the filing cabinet too. It's a classy lawyer drunk move.
I mean, at least it's not liquor, you know?
Yeah, it's good. Yeah. And leaving the note for his non-existent secretary, I thought was a nice touch of him upping, trying to make himself look a lot more professional than he was.
Oh, too. Yeah, for sure. And it's a good, I've got to cover up my issues instead of actually dealing with them sort of thing. Like, he's clearly had to do this a few times, you know, like he knows how to hide a hangover a little bit, you know?
Yeah. By punching some tape onto the window.
Yeah, that's great too. That's how they did it in the '80s, man.
I guess so.
Also cold cuts in bars. The all purpose bar. Like, it's like a Chuck E. Cheese for lawyers or like alcoholic lawyer adults, you know? Like, it's got everything you need. It's got eggs on the bar in the morning for what you need to put in your beer. It's got pinball, or metaphorical pinball that you can play. It's got Jimmy apparently can make steaks, and also there's a cold cut fridge. Like, it's just crazy. That place is crazy.
And a unrefrigerated carton of eggs on the desk for anybody who needs them.
I feel like that's a thing that those eggs come out when Jimmy opens up in the morning, and then at about 10 a.m. he puts them away.
Yeah.
Which is fine. You know, you can live with that.
Well, yeah, I think if this is how you're living your life.
Yeah, that's
some other health concerns to address.
Exactly. First. Oh, I think that egg has been on the counter for 4 hours. I'm going to step away. I'll just have my 9 a.m. Bushmills straight up instead, you know?
Yeah. What a champ.
Yeah. Another thing I like about this movie, Paul Newman orders his drinks by name as opposed to just saying a whiskey, which is something I always like by brand name, I mean, which is something always like seeing in a movie, because it never happens in real life that somebody's at a bar and is like, I'll have a beer, and that's the end of the conversation, you know?
Yeah. So. Any movie taking place after 1880 where they have one of anything at the bar.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, Mickey, when he's with Laura, he just orders beer and Jimmy brings them two beers. But so it's not like this movie is totally avoids that thing that bothers me. But in Paul Newman's case, it does. So that's good.
Laura really does get put through the ringer in this way.
Does not treated well. Not treated well.
Like, she's literally a tool for a while, just to be used by the other law firm. It's just one of those ones where, you know, she gets, it doesn't seem as though she likes her work as a spy. Find someone that she does like and loses that. And I don't know how much of a drunk she was before, but at the end, it's not looking great for her.
No, exactly. I mean, I think she's meant to mirror Frank, like where Frank was when he gets not disbarred but gets fired from his law firm and is divorced, because Laura is also divorced, you know, not for reasons that, or she says she's divorced, whether or not that's true, who knows, that's not attached to this actual case at all, but it's still a part of her character. And I think what she is meant to be is like somebody that represents Frank right after his life goes down the tubes, and is she going to come out of it, or is she gonna have to deal with potentially a decade or two of similar sadness to Frank's, you know?
Yeah, that's what I mean by not liking you know, the work that she's doing, and I was, like, so drunk she can't even put her drink down without just spilling it onto the floor.
And she appears to be eating breakfast at that point, too.
It's pretty grim.
Yeah, exactly. And one thing I really like about, another thing I really like about this movie, the way that she is revealed as somebody that's working for Kincannon, we get that scene of James Mason talking about how things, you know, he pays for his whiskey, pay for your clothes, stuff like that. Because she's clearly having doubts about what she's been doing. And, you know, there are scenes in this movie, especially early on, when she says that she'll stay the night when Frank is really stressed out about something, and he's just like, "Oh, you will?" And she's like, "And we don't know that she's working for Canada at that point." And then you just assume that she rifled through his stuff all night, you know, like when he's passed out asleep. That it was just very nefarious, right? And,
yeah.
And then later, after she meets with after the scene with Kim Cannon that I will get back to, I swear. There's when she goes out for cigarettes after our boy Jack Warden is like, "Laura, cigarettes, remember? We need cigarettes." When they're calling around trying to find the person that would end up being the star witness. She knows what they're doing. She knows where they're looking. And then she goes outside, goes downstairs, gets the cigarettes. And then she's looking at this bank of phones. And, we don't get any resolution on that scene. We don't know if she calls Kim Cannon to tell them that, what Frank and Mickey are looking for. By the way that the rest of the movie goes, we assume that she didn't, because it seems like Kincannon was unprepared for what happened.
Yeah.
Even though he worked his way out of it. Ed Kincannon, total pro. Prince of fucking darkness, but the total pro. But yeah, and exactly. And there's just some of these little scenes where we don't quite know which side Laura is really on that I liked. And the one, the establishing her as part of Kincannon's group is really cool, because James Mason's giving this whole speech, and then he's pouring a drink, and then the reveal comes by the camera, like that Laura's been working for him. The reveal comes via a whiskey glass being passed, right? It's like she is being given this alcohol, which is also not good for Frank to be around, you know. And I thought that was a really cool subtle thing that I don't know, ties the two things together to me. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, we just don't know how much she was drinking before, but her being given that drink and saying, you know, it's this kind of work that pays for our whiskey. And then we see what the whiskey has done to her by the time that the movie's over. And it really backs up just how, you know, nefarious this whole lifestyle is. It's just tough watching what I don't think are bad people doing bad things, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's her, you know, part of her struggle throughout this movie is that I don't think she's the kind of person who likes doing this and is just in that spot where it's what she has to do, she feels.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, it's good. It's all good. I just like this movie a lot. One thing that our boy Stephen Benedict, who has a very good short film podcast that is much better than ours, but like
much shorter.
Yeah, exactly. He's a sharp dude, but he did an episode on The Verdict a couple years ago, and he's talked about like a lot of the ways that Frank is trapped throughout this movie, like with framing and all these things. And Paul Newman suggested to Sidney Lumet that his character should be asthmatic, which I don't think ever gets mentioned in the script, but or in the actual movie, but is something that was thought about because he can't breathe in this world that he's in. And the color red is apparently used quite a bit throughout the movie. And there's not a lot of color in the movie, so red is kind of the only one that's there, and it really pops when it is there. And it's sort of supposed to be representative of hell, basically. Like in this old world, there's always like these little pieces of hell that are just kind of just under the surface or just bubbling out to try and reach you and pull you down. And and that's what Frank is trying to avoid. And I think that's a really cool reading on how they use color in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the last really wonderful smart filmmaking thing that I guess two, but when the doctor finishes his testimony, the doctor who ends up being found guilty of malpractice, or whatever the actual classification is.
Is it Towler?
Yeah, I don't know. You can make up anything.
Okay.
That sounds like a good guess. I support it. I support my podcaster and partner in podcasting. Anyway, as he's walking away from the stand, it's like he's walking away. Like he feels really good about what he's done, and he feels like he's off, like he feels like he's safe. And so the camera follows him, and there are very few tracking shots in this movie that actually follow a character, and we're actually watching him walk away, kind of like not the scene of the crime, but walking away from a place where that is actually it's actually decided whether or not there was a crime. And we're following him, and then the nurse gets called, and he stops in his tracks and has to look behind him, right? Like he has to, not behind him, but we see his head over his own shoulder, and as he he looks to the judge, I think, and he just has to stop in his tracks, and he's not clean yet. He's not out of there. And I thought that was a really, really great, great shot, especially since it stands out so much from so many of the other shots, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, literally something from his past coming up, you know, this nurse that I guess kind of got run out of town and had to leave her job. It's, you know, your past creeping up behind you.
Yeah, exactly. And then we get, after all of that, and we get Frank's closing arguments, and the way the camera, you know, we start in this very a wide shot that's not unlike what we've seen so much of already, where there are so many little pieces in the frame, specifically people watching the case, the jury, Frank, Mickey, Concannon, and all these people, and the camera sort of slowly cranes in as Paul Newman is talking, and towards the end we get him in kind of a one shot where he is the only person in focus in the frame, and it just sort of, it really represents the personal plea that he is making to these people that you know, like this is what I think, and I hope you will join me in this frame. We used to all be in this frame together, and now as I speak I'm just saying what I think, and hopefully you will be okay with this, you know, and it's the only way I can win is just by being a better human being than the people I'm up against. And and I think
and appealing to the jury to do the same thing and overlook these little rules but do the clear moral right choice.
Exactly. And like just watching this movie from the perspective of somebody that knows how big of a star Paul Newman was and the kind of clout that he could command on set, like there's just a lot of things in this movie that really make him look unflattering, and he doesn't seem to have a problem with any of them, and it just makes me like Paul Newman even more than I already did, you know, like
somehow
he just seems like the type of person that it's like, if you can give him a good reason for why this is better for the movie, then he's like, of course, why not, Sydney? That's a good idea. You know, like, and I just, I don't know. I obviously enjoy, superstars that, view other people as equals, you know, despite them living in a certain kind of rarefied air. And, I think this movie's a really good showcase for that in Paul Newman's perspective, you know?
Yeah, no, he's supposed to just look run down and tired and kind of beaten down by the career and life that he has. And so he looks that way despite, you know, being able to look better than that, clearly. Yeah. It works for the movie so well, so he does it.
Yeah, and so then we've got that last scene after the case where Laura is is drunk and calling Frank in his office, and the phone or the movie ends with the phone just ringing and Frank not picking up, and Laura hasn't hung up. She's still holding out hope, but we'll see. So what do you think happens at the end of the movie?
It's tough. I don't know. I mean, it ends, so nothing really happens.
Wow. Great. Very helpful.
No, I honestly don't know, because I think from his perspective, I mean, he doesn't know any of her apprehensions about doing this or any of her reasons maybe for needing the money or, you know, ending up having different feelings about who he is as a person than the ones she was just paid to pretend to have. So, you know, you could see him going either way with it.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think we're supposed to hope that he picks up the phone just because of the way
to save her,
but not even to save her, but to continue with the saving of himself, you know, like, because she's just so representative of what he was going through previously, and he can kind of help her very early on in that process, as opposed to, as we said, all of these years passing of her playing pinball by herself while drinking beer in the morning. And you know, I think just she has realized that she's working for a law firm that maybe doesn't have the best intentions. She has specifically deceived somebody that she seems to at least like. And regardless from a romantic perspective, just like as a person, you know, she's by the end of the movie seems to think that Frank has his head in the right place. And I think we're supposed to want him to pick up the phone to help somebody out, and not even just from any sort of romantic perspective, but just to help somebody that is potentially on their own descent into alcoholism. And the so much of the movie is about giving a second chance to people. And I think we're supposed to want him to give a second chance, and he has to find it within himself to give this other person a second chance, to have faith in this person being able to pull themselves out of the garbage institution that is the legal system, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's what we're supposed to think. And that's certainly what I think. And I mean, I don't have a hard answer as to whether or not he actually picks up the phone or is willing to do so in the future. Like, even if he doesn't pick up on this call, maybe there's another call, you know? And I don't know.
It's just
interesting. Like, if he's quote unquote willing to be the change he wants to see in the world or whatever, you know?
Yeah, no, it seems that just the way he fought for this case and all the indications we get about what he's going to do with his future, then he has a certain faith in people that would make him want to be helpful and to forgive her. So
yeah, I think exactly. You're right. Because realistically, he has every right to not care about her at all. Yeah. He had no right to hit her, but he has every right to not pick up the phone. You know, that's still allowed in culture, not picking up the phone. But yeah, I don't know. I still think it's a really interesting question that I have occasionally pondered over the past 10 years after watching this movie. And I think that it really speaks to how this movie, you know, it's not my favorite movie by any means, but it's a really great example of everybody just doing their job really, really well. And the legal thriller is such a well-worn genre. And to do it at this level and have it still resonate 34 years later, I think it's a real testament to the skill of everybody involved. And I mean, just listing off movies that Sidney Lumet has directed, even just the ones that we've done podcasts for, we've now done The Verdict, Dog Day. We did Network as well. And I assume we'll do a 12 Angry Men podcast at some point, you know, and those are just four of his movies. You know, it's just, I think he has with time become such an underrated director just because he never did anything flashy. And I think I've mentioned this in every podcast we've done for a Sidney Lumet movie. And, I don't know. I think it's great, you know? And if this ends up being Paul Newman's time capsule movie, which I don't think it is, but, I think it's a worthy entry. You know, I think it really speaks to everything I like about Paul Newman as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I've got a phone call. I'll figure out whether or not I'm going to pick it up. But yeah, check back with us next week where we'll be talking about something else.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.